And then we talk a bit about the purpose in a concept of spiritual, but most of it is, what is your purpose? Because if you're going to fail, and you're going to fail fast and forward, it's got to be towards something. So quite a bit of the book is repeating that principle, which is, unless you have a purpose, you can be a good leader, but to be an outstanding leader, you've got to have an outstanding purpose or a clear purpose.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast. Today we are joined by Colin Hunter, author of Be More Wrong. I mean, could I be more wrong most of the time? John will be chuckling. So I'm delighted to get into this and what it's all about. Colin is the CEO of Potential Squared International, a consultancy company about getting the best out of people. He's going to tell us all about that. But we are really here today to talk about, I guess, the power of failure, the power of being wrong. But Colin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, John. And you've just made my daughter's day, because she's been asking me for a while, saying, so when can we get the Chandler's line, could I be more wrong? I think it's Chandler, Joey, I had a friend. So you've just done it. So I can say we've succeeded in that already.
A massive Friends fan. I think you should get T-shirts for your book.
That would be.
You should do, absolutely. But welcome to the pod. For our listeners that haven't heard of you, would you like to introduce yourself, your company, and what you do, please?
Yeah, so I'm Colin Hunter, CEO, founder of Potential Squared. So Potential Squared, and some people ask, why not Potential Cubed? And we always say under promise, over deliver, which was the moment when we were trying to define the name. But we've been going since about 2001, worked globally. We've come up with the analogy and the purpose of creating a playground to disrupt the way people are led in a measurable way as well. So we've got a lot of awards now around the measurement, and I'm a big, being a Scotsman, I don't know if I can say this, but being a Scotsman, it's always about the budget, and it's always about budgets, and is this worth the investment? So even just listening to the time of somebody taking the time to listen to this podcast today, is it worth the investment of their time to listen to me to speak? So we've had measurable in our DNA for a while now, and we're starting to prove that we can get results in that. But we use actors, and we used VR. So immersive is the other element of our work. So we try to recreate your scenarios, client scenarios, or just conversations, difficult conversations. The most conversations are the same, whether it's trying to influence upwards, whether it's trying to coach somebody, or whether it's trying to get past no in what you're doing. So we tend to bring tailored role plays into there to bring it to life. And that's what we do. Yeah.
This is quite unique. It's a unique kind of approach. Yeah. What's the genesis of this? How did this all start?
Well, it basically started because if I look back at a couple of things, my first part of my life and my career was a major set of screw-ups where I set about trying to measure up to my grandfather and my father. My grandfather was a professor of theology and always wanted me to be the bright and shiny and knowledgeable and intellectual that I never was. And my dad was invented echo for babies' hearts, so saved loads of babies' lives. And I was sat there thinking, for most of my life, I've got to live up to them. And it was only at about the age of 30 where I collapsed on a golf course, basically had a breakdown, I realized that I had to live in my way, and I had to find my own way. So I spent the rest of my career, and since I founded the business in 2001, practicing what I preach to learn systems, habits that allow me to be successful and sustainable in what I do, and dance to my own music and rhythm, which that's what we coach other people, is how do you dance to your own rhythm and find your own rhythm in your life and your work. Yeah, so that's how it started. And it gets me out of bed in the morning, bouncing out of bed, thinking, you know, so what's new? What's exciting? What's the latest thing that we're going to be working on? Yeah.
That must have been a fair challenge for you, really, because most people would have gone, well, I just need to keep actually achieving like my father did, like my grandfather did. But you looked at it in a very different way, said, actually, what can I actually learn from being in that situation?
And I'm not saying it was perfect, John. You know, I spent 2 weeks in floods of tears and thinking, you know, what have I done here? But there's a principle in here. When I look back at my decisions after that, I made a decision to basically leave Procter & Gamble to go and do an MBA. And in the MBA, for a year, I allowed and gave myself permission to be myself. And in that year, I had a massive inferiority complex. I had imposter syndrome, but I was suddenly facing off to CEOs of Ford or Tesco, and I was facing some senior people, and I suddenly realized the skills that I have are very, very useful. They might not be the same technical, financial, intellectual skills that they have, but the ability to build rapport with somebody is amazing. And so therefore, I've started to work on that. And then I realized that I did some chemistry experiments. I don't know if you've ever done this in your life, but I had two or three sets of friends. And I thought, well, I'm a friend with all these sets of friends. And therefore, in theory, they could all come together and work and they'd get on. And I brought these, it was a failure. You know, they didn't get on well. And I started to work out that I was working on something that I have that was useful. Then I was starting to think about, so how do I facilitate conversations between people to expose what their true purpose is and what they want to do? I wasn't calling it that in those days. And then I got a reputation for when I was coaching and working the coaching side, people would say, bring a box of tissues to Colin's coaching sessions because there's going to be tears. But it was not in a fearful, well, a threatening way. It was that what I was trying to do was get them to early on in a safe environment, tap into the tears that I had about the person I wanted to be and had spent my life. So how do I do that safely, get them to feel safe in there? And so that's what I did. So it wasn't easy. I'm still working it, still a work in progress, still massively failed. I mean, a lot of my client friends are joking and saying, appropriate book, Mr. Hunter. Appropriate book. Yeah. You couldn't be more wrong to quote Rachel's in there. But therefore, it's a life's work to see if I can get other people who have screwed up and feel inadequate because of their screw ups can realize that you can turn around and you can put into something different and use it for different people. Yeah.
I just want to tap into this idea around learning from making a mistake, from screwing up. When we are sort of coached around the idea of people should spend more time honing their strengths and not particularly concentrating on perceived weaknesses.
Yep.
Is it around the word perceived, as in I might think that I'm not very good at that, but actually you can show me a way that I might be?
I think I'll play on your strengths bit for a while, and just because I'm a big believer in strengths, and in a lot of ways, my story is about finding what I was good at and working on that. So yeah. I'm a big believer in that. But to accept what I am, even with authenticity, everybody says, "Oh, you've got to be authentic nowadays." And the Prince Herminia Arbar at London Business School had a great quote in this. She says, "Authenticity is a learnt; it's a process." So even if I bring my authentic self to one scenario, in theory, if I stretch myself and I push myself through something, I've got a new version of my authentic self now because I've experienced, I've learned something and worked on it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, even if I've got a strength, say my strength is numbers, and we do a lot of work in finance and internal audit. If my strength is numbers, there still is a stretch to learn how to create simple words around numbers, even commentary on financial documents. There still is a stretch. And what we're trying to do is almost to balance that with a degree of we've still got to get them to learn other things. So an overdone strength can be just as bad as an underdone, you know, or a weakness in some way. So so we've been trying to do that. So there is a piece just on the strengths. Having the excuse in your language which says, well, that's just me. That's my strength. That's all I'm focused on. That doesn't work for me because there's another person on the other side. And if you're working with other people, you've got to bring your music and dance to them, but you've also got to learn how to work and with their music and their dance in there. So the strengths bit is, yeah, let's get solid. Let's get some solid stakes in the ground about what you do and what you're good at. And then there's this growth piece, which is this wisdom piece, which is knowledge speaks knowledge. And then moving to wisdom, which is I grow and I start to experiment. I start to stretch myself. And then if I stretch myself or I stretch myself before the world stretches me, then I'm more resilient for what I'm going to face. And that's the other element of what we're looking at is, you know, look at COVID and what we've experienced. We didn't know it was going to happen. We didn't know how we're operating. There's so many leaders at the moment who are broken. They are literally broken. They are sitting probably listening to this podcast and going, I am most tired. I am probably slightly, because it's August and it's British weather if you're in Britain, I'm slightly depressed by the weather. How am I going to motivate myself to get back out there? So it's this, there's a degree of resilience as well. Not only focusing your strength, but how do I build resilience to face what I'm going to face? That's a long answer to a short question, but hopefully it answers it. Yeah.
I think just what I quite liked about what you said initially, and I think where it would be good to take this conversation is there's learning from failure, which we all talk about a lot. But when you said about that sitting in that screw up and experiencing that screw up, and there might be strengths to John, like what John said, that you can use to get you out of that. But I'm thinking about when I worked in the corporate world, a lot of screw ups I saw, that initial reaction when you screw up phenomenally is the fight or flight, right? You'll either fight, which is to defend yourself and to come up with excuses. There's the flight, which is it's going to be pretty horrendous for the next month, but I'll just get my CV together and I'll move on and then there's the aspect of learning from a screw up. But there's learning from a screw up as a solitary person, where I think some of my screw ups have been so big, but actually it's maybe taken me years to learn from them. But the experience of learning whilst you're in it as a team, as a leader, I mean, I'm out of my depth talking about that. I don't know. So, I mean, do you want to touch on that and elaborate on that? Because I think that's a dance that leaders are going to have to get better at, because if anybody hasn't made a mistake in COVID, then I don't know where you've been, right? And you've got to get through that as a leadership team. So where's your head at with that kind of stuff?
So I was lucky. I was given a gift. I was introduced to a gentleman called Andrew Webster. And I met him. And so it was one of our South African consultants who said, you've got to get into this design thinking philosophy. Now, a lot of your listeners have probably heard of design thinking, but if you haven't, it's about user-centered design. So where you start to go out and observe, you leave your ego and the expertise at the door, and you go out and you observe people in their real environments. And through that observation, you come up with insights and ideas and ideation. But a core principle in there is that you're going to take very early an idea and you're going to test it with experiments, small experiments. So I met Andrew Webster, and it was a bit like a covert meeting in Paddington Station. Now, he says I'm building this up, but I still remember it. He was in a trench coat. You know, you felt like the CIA had walked in. But what he gave me was the ability to see that life is a small series of experiments. And therefore, if you're experimenting, you're looking to fail. And if you look at all the big organizations and you look at Pixar now, and the first version of their movies is always going to be ugly. It is always going to, they're expecting it. So therefore, they're looking with the rest of their colleagues and their peers, who in theory they're competing with, but they have this lunch where they watch the movie and it gets torn apart, but they're already set it up because, so imagine if you went into a program you're going to run and you said, this is just a pilot. We're prototyping a new way of working. So therefore I want you in that mindset as participants to go through this with the experience of, we might get it slightly wrong, we might get it right, but we're learning it, but we're putting you at the center of the experience. To do that now is what you need to do as a leader. And therefore, as a leader, if you look at all the organizations, they're putting design thinking in there. And they're saying, whether it's Procter & Gamble, who work directly with their customers to test new products, they're putting it out there. Or simply, whether it's the Rosewood London, is one of our clients, testing a new room service or testing a new product, you're expecting failure. You're expecting to learn from it. If you're not learning from it, then you're probably not stretching yourself far enough in the environment. So therefore, I think there's a couple of things that go to your point, Rachel. One is organizational objective setting, annual planning, bonuses are all predicated on pre-existing objectives. And what James Clear talks about is, we don't rise to the level of objectives, we fall to the level of our systems. So as a leader, if you're creating a system of fresh ideas, experimentation, and very quickly you're identifying the ones that are failing and going, right, let's get rid of that. And key thing is involving your clients. So the awards we've won have involved working with our clients very early on to say, we are going to screw up. We're going to fail. but you're with us in this, but we're also going to invite the participants in to be part of that screw up. And so we've invented new stuff coming out of these programs that is making us look good, but a lot of it has been learning from those participants being involved in the learning. Now that's a new culture. It's a design thinking culture. It's what Ozan Varel calls, wrote a book called Think Like a Rocket Scientist. If you haven't read it, it's a great book. But he talks about learn fast rather than fail fast. How are you going to learn fast? So therefore, that's where I would come from. It's got to be learn fast, and it's got to be leadership who are driving that. And that's why I believe most leaders are set up to look at annual objectives and meet those rather than really learn fast with their teams. Yeah.
You must get so much more engagement from that, though, because I was just thinking when you were talking there, we've done a very similar thing with a program that we're in at the moment, where we've laid a framework out that we know that will work, yet there are lots of bits and pieces that need to go into that we don't know the content of. Yeah. But in order for it to be useful to the people that are on that program, they are included in that design. And I've never articulated it in the way that you have. Mm. But effectively that is what we are doing now. And we have noticed so much more engagement on that basis, because they feel as if they're part of the solution rather than sit there and just be told what to do.
Yeah. We have something called forum theater where we get two actors up front and we do Whose Line Is Anyway, if you remember the comedy show.
Yeah.
And we're basically saying to them, here's a conversation, but there could be 25 different ways of having this conversation. So you've got a remote control. We'll do your 3-minute scenario. Then you have total control, 25 people in the audience. You have total control over the actors and the hot seat, which is the conversation owner, which would be the participants, and say, now work with us for 45 minutes to explore all the different versions of this conversation. So if you can remember Airplane, the movie, where there's an hysterical passenger and they've got the queue of people, you know, calm down, the next person comes in. Just imagine that, but in the nicest possible way. Somebody might come and go, okay, well, I think you're being too harsh here. I would go softer. They try the softer, and the actors are trained to bring to life a different slap back to them to say, well, you were too soft and I've got away with this. And we just give them an experimentation way to grow it. So in the end, those 25 conversations, what they choose to take away is the conversation that's relevant to them. And therefore they feel it's the most tailored thing they've ever done, which it is, because it's their work. It's, I mean, we were talking about it earlier, but it's that Ken Robinson thing about the little girl who's drawing at the back of the class. And, you know, the teacher comes up and said, what are you doing? So I'm drawing a picture of God. And said, well, we don't know what God looks like. Well, if you give me a few minutes, I'm going to teach you. Why wouldn't we give people creativity to play around with those types of conversations? That's one of the core philosophies of our business. Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, trying to think from a listener's point of view, the value in doing that is the safety and being able to rerun and replay, so that when they are put in front of these different scenarios and situations, they've got a bigger, I guess, emotional memory of things that they've experienced.
Yeah.
Is that the thinking behind it? Because quite often when you go into a difficult situation, a difficult conversation, you are caught off guard. Otherwise, you can't predict it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be difficult. And you're not quite sure what you're capable of in that, because they're not things you can pre-program. Is that the thinking behind the business model, basically?
It is. And it's all prepared for your spontaneity session. If you're a lover of Larson cartoons, there's that one where, you know, the pad and the pen are neatly aligned on a desk and it says all prepared for your spontaneity session, you know, and we know that those conversations you're going to go into could change. It could be that somebody's just had a really bad conversation the moment before. It could be that you've built it up and it's the most easy conversation in the world when you walk in there. And if I always take it back to some sporting analogies, but if you think about tennis, and if you've ever watched the Andy Murray documentary and you see how hard he practices, to get the practice to almost have that instinct to know and almost second guess what's going to go on, but have the ability in the moment, because he's purposely practiced something, that it becomes habitual, that it becomes part of a system. So he's reading the ball flight, you know, he's reading everything in there. So they, you know, they say tennis players, the speed of the tennis ball coming down, they can tell by practice where the arm is and where the ball is just about to be hit, where the ball is going to go. But they can only, Andre Agassi did that because they beat a number of players just doing it. But that's what we're getting them to practice, to be intuitive, but to be ready, to be meeting the person in front of them that they're going to meet, but be ready to be agile in the moment to work it out. But how often do we work out on our conversations? Imagine if we politically at the moment, if we gave people a safe place to try and have different conversations and learn in a different way. I don't think we'd ever get it. And Twitter's definitely not the place to have it.
Yeah.
But wouldn't it be great if we were able to do that? Yeah.
Yeah, it would. Just before we move on the conversation, I just think it would be a miss of me not to ask on this idea of difficult conversations. And you actually probably are the podcast guest who's been doing the business for the longest, I think, in one area. So 20 years of running this business and having trained actors and thousands of difficult conversations role played. What would be your tips for people to be more agile in this moment as leaders? What are those practices that they need to implement? What are those habits that they need to be doing to become more agile? What are the surefire tips?
So one I'm going to borrow from Susan Scott, Fierce Conversations, which is a mindset of I hold 50% of the truth, the other person holds the other 50% of the truth. And I just love that, because if I'm seeking their truth and being curious about it, then for me, that I hold that space. Yeah. So that's one. I think the other bit, which I learned early on in my career, was we were taught when you were coaching somebody, was the two people, and most people are facing off against each other. So this is a visual one for the listeners, but I was always taught that the person who's teaching me always used to throw a pen that they were holding into the middle and say, let's focus on the pen. Yeah. And therefore, for me, there's a piece about now I put into language, what's the purpose of the conversation? Why am I having that? Yeah. And having that very clear in your mind. And my old colleague used to say, if a conversation, work it out, is it worth more than 6 out of 10 for you? Yeah. In terms of passion, engagement. If it is, then have the conversation. If it's not, then you're just trying to get something off your chest. So that's the second. And then the third thing for me is having practice with somebody else. And one of the things we do is tailored role plays with people. We say, what's the toughest conversation you're going to have? And it's amazing how many people will try and give the actor all the brief and everything else. And they'll have the conversation. They suddenly realize that either they don't need to have the conversation, it's something about them by doing the practice. Yeah. Or secondly, they've never lived in this world, which I love. I'm doing something on positive intelligence at the moment, which is this wisdom that you put yourself with empathy in the other person's point of view. And you suddenly realize, I'm just getting something off my chest, or it's all about me. So those would be the tips I'd have is, if I can give you one more answer, which I always, there was a story about, remember the bit I was saying about the passenger stress in the conversations. There was this forum theater we were running, and you had 25 of the top people in a top consulting firm sitting there. And there was the one person in the room was junior, and all these 25 other people were in there. They were giving it their best shot. And eventually this most junior person was the only person left standing, and the actor was still sitting there almost blowing on their knuckles and going, you know, come on. Who else has got something? And this junior person got up and he got the actor to come out of the seat, and he used the whole room and he said, right, so I've heard three points of view. And he described each corner of a room as a third a point of view. And he said, I'm going to get you to stand in each of these corners and try to see what the other points of view look like from this point of view. And he physically did this for about 5 minutes. Actor had nowhere to go. So just by putting yourself in the shoes of somebody else, but physically getting yourself out and seeing it from a different point of view, for me, that's why practice conversations help, because suddenly you're in the moment. It's not just thinking about it, it's doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And having those practice conversation with somebody that's impartial.
Yeah.
Because quite often we go and find our greatest ally.
Yeah, aren't they terrible? Yeah, they are.
Aren't they terrible? Never have a practice conversation with your partner at home. Oh, actually, mine might be quite good for that, because he loves disagreeing with me. But
common theme rather.
But it is that, like, not finding your ally. And I think when you do seek that and you hear it, you know, I'm doing a little bit of work at the minute on anxiety, and I think we have so many of these conversations in our head, but we can speak so fast to ourselves in our head that we can't actually verbalize it at that 600 words per second, which is what you can think at. When you actually say it out loud much slower, I think maybe the key, what I'm hearing you say, is very good leaders are good at choosing not to get things just off their chest. It's that making that key differential. Is it important? Is it a position of interest? Well, is it a point of interest rather than me coming at it from a position of what's important to me?
Yeah. And I think the leader's angle, bringing that back in, is an important one, because a lot of the work now in Amazon is about, if you've got a, say you've got a proposal, then Amazon, they get people to write the proposal and they get to write it in a positive aspect. I don't know if you've heard this before. I'm sure you're nodding, so you probably have. But then they put it into the meeting. Everybody reads it at the same time. So nobody's read it before on the pop.
No PowerPoint. It has to be on a proposal.
Yes. It has to be put. And then they get the person with the least authority or the least impact on the proposal to give their views first. And the last person to speak is the person who's written the proposal. Now, that's another way of, you know, getting conversations out there, getting information out there. And so for me, it's always about, if we take ourselves out of it and we get out of our own way, leadership and coaching is pretty easy. Yeah. And I'm sure you've done this in your role where you've coached somebody for an hour, which I've just done, and you can't remember how much you value you've added to that person. They say, that's the best coaching session I've ever had. You know, and you're thinking, I didn't do anything. But a lot of the times that's the leader's role, is just to facilitate, to create the conditions for us to get stuff off our mind, even when we're anxious as a leader to do that. So I think there's that. And I think it then goes into leaders. Some of the biggest problems people have are their leaders. So how do we get people to have those anxious conversations with their leaders and their managers in their workplace? Why not get them to practice it? Yeah. And then get the leaders to really go stretch themselves, sail the ship out of the harbor, or go to the rougher seas, with having a trained person having a different type of conversation with them. I'd prefer to have people who have been capable or very capable in my business stretching me in my conversations than not. Yeah. Maybe that's just me, but that makes for a good business in my book.
Yeah. I think the thing where it gets difficult is when not everybody's on the same page doing that. And so, for example, if you've got a leader who isn't capable of, or isn't doing that, everybody's capable of it, whether or not they choose to is another option. But how can you manage up to do that if that's the position that you're coming from?
Yeah, and I think this probably is a very long conversation, because I coach a lot of people who have to make choices about leaving businesses. Yeah, and we've got a reputation for encouraging people to leave businesses for the right reasons, or not getting promotion. Well, one of the fundamental conversations that we have with people is, you know, why do you want to be MD? Why do you want to get promoted? And once you get under the skin of it, most people don't. They just want the title or the better pay. So I do think there's this preparing people for why they're doing, the purpose in there. But I do think leaders have a big part to play. And I don't think we either educate leaders in the best way. I don't think we have the best leaders. So I'm starting a project next year called the 500, but it's to increase equity in the 18 to 30 year olds when they're making their career choices, to help them start to choose a better path and realize their potential. And what I'm hoping is that we uncover a whole list of unlikely leaders, leaders with quirky personalities who bring a difference to leader. Because wouldn't it be great if you went into work and had fun rather than with somebody who was pretending to be something they're not, with a suit on, or, you know, or with an attitude which was, I'm getting paid to do this and I don't particularly like it. So that's what we've got to do. But that's a lifelong journey to work on.
How are you choosing those people, Colin, or are they coming to you? How, if somebody was interested in the 500,
yeah,
how would they access that potential slot, if you like?
So, I mean, what we're going to do is, actually, we're going to try, we're eating our own dog food, drinking our own champagne, whatever the expression is you want to use, but we're going to crowdfund it. So we're actually going to put the seats up for for people to buy them. So organizations can buy them, they can buy them. But only 400 of those will be paid seats. The other 100 will be for not-for-profit. So those will be free seats. And the others will fund the 100. So the aim is that you get a diverse mix of people coming in. So people can apply for them, whether they're not-for-profits or the pieces if they want to do that, but they can apply for the paid seats. And we're not charging a huge amount of money for it. You know, a lot in terms of certain people's lifestyles, we're not charging a huge amount of money because the aim is that it becomes a commercial enterprise itself, funds itself. But we're also working with Blueprint for All, which is a Stephen Lawrence Trust. Yeah, so we're working to start to do that. And they've got a whole bunch of mentors given to them by organizations who need to be trained. So we're using that as a training vehicle. We've got India signing up, and we've got a couple of organizations like Accenture and HSBC wanting to evolve it. But the aim is to give people such a rich amount of experience as mentors and coaches that by the end of the year, they have to give back, pay it forward, but they have to give back to society. They have to give opportunities to 18, 30-year-olds who wouldn't have had it before. So they can basically sign up. And, if they come into the Be More Wrong, get in contact, we can tell you a bit more about that. But I'm excited because that's me doing something which has a fundamental impact on the fabric of society, which is my bit.
Well, you're paying forward, aren't you?
Yeah.
We'll put a link in the show notes if anybody's interested in that. I'm just thinking now, so let's move on to Be More Wrong. What is the premise of the book and the premise of Be More Wrong?
So the premise is hero's journey, actually. So if you're familiar with the hero's journey, every culture has a hero's journey, but most people would know Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, and you think about those, and you think about... So rather than thinking, so how do I become the perfect person leader overnight? The whole premise is, what is the hero's journey? How do I leave home? How do I leave the place I am? How do I gather around the right people for me? So how do I get the Fellowship of the Ring or Hermione and Ron to sign up with me? And how do I get a guide? And who is that guide, whether it's Dumbledore or whoever it is to work with them? And then the second premise is, how do I, once I've engaged that team, how do I start to inspire with storytelling? But the most important is, how do I become more resilient? So the second part of that journey is, how do I stretch myself, face good and evil in the hero's journey and work? And then the whole principle is, we get to the next phase, which is, how do I create fresh ideas? How do I experiment? How do I challenge? How do I make the right decisions? And then the loop is closed by going back into growth and capability. How do I take time out to be mentored and coached, to learn and grow, and then start again, but never go back to the village the same way because you've changed so much? So that's the premise. It's a systems, habits, and practices book for leaders to grow their teams, to experiment, to get their teams to sail the ship out of the harbor in a different way and seek rougher seas.
So this is stretch and rest.
Equals growth.
Yeah. Equals growth.
Yeah.
Tell us more about the practices and habits that underpin those.
So if I give you a flavor of a couple of, so if you think about engaged teaming, psychological safety is a big one at the moment. Everybody is saying, so how do I create a psychologically safe team? But we tend to get people to go on training courses. Now, I'm not saying anything about training courses, but there's something about, send them on a training course, they suddenly come back. And are they psychologically safe? No, the leader's got to do some small experiments. So what we're talking about in the engaged teaming is, how does the leader, for example, warm their team up in the morning? How do they do small experiments to get them to share conversations? We shared the Amazon one. How do they get them to amplify their voice and do that? So we give them certain, in the book, it's about simple stories, but we also teach them simple practices that become habits that can fuel that system of engaged teaming. And then in the drive and resilience, we talk a lot. This is one of my biggest passions, is around resilience. So we talk about, how do I get my own properly selfish focus to my life, to create my own energy systems, my own resilience, to become Nicholas Taleb with anti-fragile. How do I become anti-fragile and work in a way which is resilient? And so we talk a lot about the physicality, the mental strength to do that. And then we talk a bit about the purpose in a concept of spiritual, but most of it is what is your purpose? Because if you're going to fail and you're going to fail fast and forward, it's got to be towards something. So quite a bit of the book is repeating that principle, which is unless you have a purpose, you can be a good leader, but to be an outstanding leader, you've got to have an outstanding purpose or a clear purpose in there. And then it's about experimentation. So we go through, not in enough depth for you to get the whole principles of design thinking. And then we use my friend Michael Bungay Stanier, Coaching Habit. And we would do some work. If you've come across his book, The Coaching Habit, absolutely bestseller, brilliant book. And he's a brilliant guy. But we do some work around coaching and mentoring so that we give them the systems. And his simple ones are things like what's on your mind, or what's on your mind and what else. So we give simple tips in the book about what it would be like to start off experiment with those systems in there. That's what it's about.
Let's unpick that a little bit, because if you're au fait with coaching, all that would make sense. But if you're a leader that's or a manager in a team that's maybe been on a couple of management courses, but don't know what system thinking is, don't know what all this stuff. Let's do the 101 version of that. Give me one example of how that might come to life for somebody who's experiencing it on the front line in a role.
I'll take the practice, habit, and system piece first. And if I can, I'll just take it into the resilience and the drive piece.
Me too.
So what I've been trying to do with my life is work out how I could be more resilient. So I started with a simple Headspace. For those who know the Headspace app, I wanted to do meditation. So I started a practice of doing 20 minutes in the morning, and I'm now on 1,350 days consecutively in there. But it moved from being a practice of 20 minutes in the morning into becoming a habit. So it's now habitual. And if I don't do it, even on Christmas Day, if I don't do it, I don't feel like I've started my day in the right way to do that. And therefore, it's feeding the system of what we call falling out of your thinking, meditation. Now, on the back end of that, I realized that I need to do exercise. So what I've worked out in the morning is I got up earlier, I do a workout, and then what I've done is become a practice of a HIIT workout in the morning for an hour. And what I've done is I've nested the other habit, which is Headspace, on the top of it. So I do my workout, and then I sit for 20 minutes doing Headspace. That's fueling the system of health and spiritual and resilience. So what we're talking about here is experimenting with small practices that other people can give you, and working them, and then finding out whether it works for you or not. And quite a few of them don't. So I'm testing something which is a Whoop, which is measuring my sleep. So I'm doing it for sleep, but I'm measuring the sleep I have and how much. And I'm realizing I am much more effective when I've had a decent amount of sleep and I've rhythm. So that's a practice I'm hopefully going to get habitual on. And then it creates a system. So with all these practice habits and systems, all we're doing is we're starting to say, so how do I become more resilient in that? On the coaching side, if you think about the difficulty of being a coach as a leader, is we have a lot of points of view. And that if you talk about supervising anybody who's a coach, normally the International Coaching Federation would say, don't give your point of view. And Michael's even written his book called The Advice Trap on the back end of it, the advice monster that creeps up there. So there's a piece in there that he gives you some great questions, some great practices, like starting with every coaching conversation or every conversation as a leader, what's on your mind? Now, what that does is it firstly gets you into habit of doing that, but it secondly, it puts the onus on the other person who's your direct report. Every conversation is about what's on their mind, not what's on the leader's mind. So it becomes something that fuels a system of growth that they're expecting that they know it and they're going to come up on that. And then it's...
What I really love about that is if you create that as a practice and a habit, you're not in telling mode then.
You aren't. Yeah.
Therefore, you are becoming a coach, not a manager, and then becoming a leader. Sorry, I interrupted, but...
No, it's exactly right. Yeah.
People would think, well, why would I ask that? But it's... Actually, if you ask that first, you're encouraging them to think differently and you're seeing another perspective, you're becoming more open, and therefore it becomes a nice habit. I really liked as well that you asked that question around how do you warm your team up? Because I think that would be a new concept for a lot of people, and actually you wouldn't dream of just going and running a half marathon, and yet, you know, without a warm-up, and yet we expect our teams to do it daily.
Exactly. And also, if you think about how much rubbish we have in our minds when you start up a team session, wouldn't it be great? We do something called bucket dumping, which is you're allowed for 10 minutes to whinge and moan about anything. Can be anything, and it's in confidence, so you can, clients, colleagues, whatever, you can just get it off your chest. What happened last night? Yeah. But if you don't, then people have all this cluttered in their mind and work on this. So there's a simple practice that you can get it. Now, after a while, people don't need it because they know it's possible, but also they start to amplify their voice because they didn't get told off, they didn't get wrong for saying what they thought the last time, so they're willing to say it. So warming up here can be as simple as, yeah, it's just, how's your day going? Pretty rubbish, actually. I'll tell them all, yeah, is a great way of warming up your team. But if you're doing design thinking, we have rock, paper, scissors that we do with design thinking. So if you have a large group, great exercise, rock, paper, scissors, and they have to battle each other in pairs and rock, paper, scissors. Now, to get them in design thinking mode, the key thing is when they lose, the person who loses has to support the person who's won, yeah, as they go off to the next battle in rock, paper, scissors. And all we're doing is we're getting to think that it's not about ego and design thinking. So by the end, where you've got two people faced off in the room, rock, paper, scissors, and they're battling, you've got a whole series of supporters behind them chanting their names in there. But there's an example of warming people up to get ego and expertise out the door. You're focused on what is the best idea, and it might not be yours. So how are you going to support others to work? So you've got to be creative. You've got to amplify that. But there's an example of warming up your team. Yeah.
I disrupted you or distracted you. Bring it back to...
yeah, we're coaching and mentoring. Yeah,
yes, please do. Coaching.
Yeah. And it, see, I'm an opinionated person. You can't tell from this call, I'm sure, or this podcast, but I have opinions. But so when I was coaching people, I haven't got an ICF qualification. And in fact, you know, when people say to me, why not? It's because my belief is that I've been coached by a number of people who have qualifications, and it hasn't been effective for me. But the underlying be more wrong transparency piece is I struggle not to give my opinion. Now, what we've found is mentoring is about giving your opinion. And if you think about how you start a conversation with most people, the mentoring conversation starts the same as the coaching conversation. What's on your mind? And it goes, and what else? And what else? And then there's decision points as you go along that conversation where you might find that this person doesn't know and they need a point of view and they need to be told. Or it might be that you realize that it's nothing to do with what they first thought and they can work it out for themselves. So we've started to implement these pieces where, for example, there's a habit of what's on your mind. There's a habit later on of crafting your own point of view. So if you've done many more podcasts than I'm doing, starting my own podcast. If I said to you, what are your top three points of view of running podcasts? Those would be the painful lessons and learnings that you'd had that you would just go through. And that would be powerful for anybody to hear running a podcast. So it's the same with leaders and mentors, is how do we get people to start to think about the practice of starting to work out, that was a bad experience, I've just been fired, but what can I use as that as a learning, as a point of view about how not to get fired? I've been fired once, been made redundant twice. I've got some strong points of view about how you avoid that or how you deal with it on the back end. So that mentoring piece is a series of systems and habits and practices in there. But what we found is that people feel relieved because they're not being asked to just coach. Yep. They've been given permission to have a point of view, as long as they do it with due care and attention, that they're not just telling for the sake of it.
And that, in essence, though, is leadership, isn't it? Because yes. You want to be having a kind of a coaching approach to leadership, but you are also there for your opinion. And it's balancing that, because if you're too much of one, you're an arsehole. And if you're too much of the other, you're just a funnel of information that goes up and down and adds no value.
Yeah.
And the skill is in the dance, right?
It is.
In finding the music to dance to for that team and with the right purpose. But less eloquently than how you.
Oh, explained. That was brilliantly done. I particularly like the A word at the beginning, because I think that's exactly how people come across when they just have points of view. Hopefully I'm not coming across that today. So, yeah.
No. So what else are the kind of, without giving the whole book away, but this real value in being wrong and, you know, in not so much celebrating it, but in picking yourself up quicker and learning from it. Like, what are those kind of practices and habits for that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things here. I'd take us out of that model, and we have three C's as leadership, and we talk about this model only works if it's driven by that at the core center a strong purpose. And then it only works if it also has an identity. So everybody has an identity that either is given or chosen. And so we do a lot of work in the book around, so what's my given? I'm a white male, Scottish. Those are my given identities. But what are my chosen identities in there? So we do a lot of work around that. For example, and this is James Clear would say, do I cycle or am I a cyclist? And by choosing an identity, you start to live and breathe. If I'm a cyclist, then that means I have to think about cycling almost as a profession. So we get people to choose the identities of working there. But the biggest area we do a lot of work on is presence. So the gravitas and prominence. And if you think about how you can get people to fail with confidence, a lot of that is about this ability to dial up and dial down gravitas and prominence in the moment with people. And have that almost that conviction with it, and then have that ability to be agile. So when you fail, it's not a case of, oh, it's a failure. It's almost that mindset of, it's a failure. Yeah. So what are we learning? And if we screw up the same way twice, that's not acceptable. So this, it's not just, well, let's go and screw up all over the place. It's towards a purpose. Yeah. It is about learning from your experiences and taking the time. And I love the story. I met a lady whose son is a Top Gun instructor. And so I spent ages just talking to her. And she says they do 1 hour of flying and about 10 hours of debrief. Yeah. How often do we do that amount of debrief of ourselves as leaders, of our mistakes or our errors? And therefore, what we're encouraging people to do is, if you're going to fail and you're consciously going to stretch yourself, give yourself the time to reflect. So stretch plus rest and reflect, and then grow. And if you don't do the rest, all you're doing is just a series of failures without any coherence to it. So those three C's, summarizing, is conviction, physicality and vocality of strength, of we can do this and we are going to make mistakes and we are going to be more wrong, but there's a purpose towards it. Conviction, which is values around that, so how you treat people, yeah, and it's values led as a leader. And then connection, which is the agility in the moment to adapt. Because sometimes you'll get it right and you go, oh, I was expecting to get it wrong, but that works. Yeah, okay, move on. Let's work it. So those are the three C's.
I think that's really useful. So thank you for sharing that. And I think there'll be a lot of people listening to this. And John, this is a note to us. We do need to probably do a podcast on meditation, because it's something that we do talk about a lot. I'm finding meditation very useful at the minute. But it's something that we do talk a lot to our coaches about, and people say, oh, I should a lot. And but it's, I think what you've just explained, I'm saying this in a very long way around, is you need to meditate to be able to sit in that uncomfortableness of failure and to do that reflection exercise. Because if, to give it that Top Gun analogy, if you're going to only fly for an hour but sit and debrief for 10 hours, what meditation teaches you is to sit with a thought and to not have to do anything with it, but just to sit and observe it. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the people that are more reflective as leaders and that become across as more present are leaders that in some way, shape or form meditate. It may be that they enjoy nature a lot, or long running, or reflective exercise, shall we say.
Yep.
But I think that model that you've just talked us through with the three C's really talks to that strength of being able to sit. You can't be wrong, like learn from being wrong, if you can't sit with the uncomfortableness of thought.
Yeah. I have a hypothesis that introverts make the best leaders. Yeah, and I'm an extrovert, so I'm dealing myself out of being one of the best leaders because I don't practice that moment of reflection and thought and consciously do that. So I have to, physically and mentally, I have to get it into my life to fall out my own thinking. But I was coached by a guy called Jamie Smart, who wrote a book called Clarity. And he talks about where do your best ideas come from? Where, and it's normally when you're falling out your own thinking, when you're in the shower, when you're on a run, whatever else it is. And so therefore you've combined that with the meditation principle, which I love, which is most of the time our life is, we're in the middle of a busy road with cars coming at us in all directions. And all meditation teaches us to do is take a step out the road and let the cars still fly by, but you have a choice to just notice the thought or deal with the thought or work with the thought. And therefore we're unfreezing a lot of our thinking and we're switching off a lot of the noise that's going on in our heads. Now, I come from Newcastle upon Tyne. Yeah. As a Geordie bloke growing up, if I'd said 20 years ago that I did meditation, I think I wouldn't have been popular. That's all I'm saying. Yeah. But it's learning that all of these things are natural. Our body is a self-correcting system, but it needs to help. It needs help in self-correcting itself. And therefore, physically, mentally, whatever it is you do, you need to be purposefully practicing as a leader to give yourself the chance to be an outstanding leader. Yeah.
Colin, you've worked with like lots and lots of different people, lots of organizations across the world. I'm really interested in, if you wouldn't mind sharing with our listeners, what are some of the best outcomes that people have achieved by building this resilience? Because often we see the problem and then just sort of mired in the problem. Yeah. And we're not actually aware that we're building the resilience. Mm. So what sort of things have you seen people achieve from that?
I've got a lady who I'll mention, who's one of my clients, Sarah Garten, just love it a bit. She works for Accenture. And she had a boomerang piece, which she left Accenture to go to another organization and came back. And she tells a story. And she's one of those inspiring women for other women, but also just for general people to listen to, because she talks about her life as a series almost of experiments to do that. But it's all about how she can become a better leader for others. So she's very much in that space. Now, is she the best at resilience? She wouldn't mind me saying this. She's learning and she's growing in that. And like all of us, we can't tickle ourselves. So, we need coaching. We need to have that piece of just going, you know what? You're going to burn out if you don't do this. But she has been brilliant at not only doing that, but by role modeling failure, role modeling resilience, her teams will do exactly the same around us. And we have a program we've been running for Accenture for about 15, more than 16 years now. And when she came and took over as the sponsor, she basically just threw it all up in the air. Yeah. And she said she wanted it to be, we call it greenhouse in the new. She wanted to push everything up in the air and say, so what are we going to do differently? Now, we were then given the permission to fail for the next 2 to 3 years. And within that, they had $2 million businesses being set up. They had social impact around all the projects. But that came from a real power of vulnerability and resilience to be in that moment. So there's one example. And I'll give you another one example, which is a guy called John in Philippines. And talk about resilience. He had this uncanny ability. If you imagine a big delivery center for this organization, he used to sit on the couch at the door. Yeah. And his only role was to welcome people and talk people. And he just sat there. And he was almost called father, uncle, whatever, by everybody, because he spent time with people. And what people appreciated that, and it's amazing how many people would die for this man, is he was just able to create a safe space for other people to share their issues, their concerns, their woes. And as a leader, for me, that's your primary purpose, which is, not quite to be a counselor, but it's to be a place where somebody can come, be honest and share. So those are just two examples of people who are just exceptional at doing that. But common theme, they do it for others. Yeah. I think that's the key. If you're doing it for others, it's easier to do. It's like habit changing. If you're doing it for somebody else, it tends to drive you more. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good message.
Very good. So before we wrap up, it is our theme to ask every guest on the podcast to share their three leadership essentials. Guessing this is a bit of a tough one for you. You've probably got three on each theme. But we're going to open the floor, you know, your three leadership essentials. Give it to us.
Essential things that people could have in their minds or practices. Yeah. Okay. So I think for one, for me is, I call it squirrel, and it's seen as a bright, shiny object syndrome. But I'm a big believer, whether it's in career, ideas, is to keep your radar on. So I'm always open to approaches on LinkedIn, new ideas, new thoughts, and I'm always bringing new things. So we've got a great tool called CoachM, which was brought by Australia, which is almost a chatbot coming in to do coaching for people. So that's one is squirrel, and do that. Second thing for me, I would suggest it's mentoring. I would say if you are not mentoring two or three other people in your life and practicing honing the points of view and the skills in there, then you're not doing the right thing for me. But also the opposite side of that, if you are not being mentored by three or four other people. So my third is linked to that, which is have an advisory board. We took it on an advisory board, and whether you're individual with three advisors in the background or like us with a business, having three people that you recruit for difference and you have as voices in your head that are telling you when you're screwing up, telling when you're on the right path, but have a differing point of view, I would have those. So that's, So mentoring, mentor, advisory board, have an advisory board for your career. If you're listening as non-leader, if you're listening as a leader, have an advisory board for your leadership. Yeah. And squirrel would be my third. Yeah.
Brilliant. We've not had those before, have we, John? So
no, tell us a little bit more about advisory board then, Colin, and actually where's the difference between that and the mentoring that you talked about?
So mentoring tends to be more one-on-one and tends to be driven by the individual coming out with, I need to be mentored. Yeah. So working in here, advisory board is a chemistry. So you got to choose the people. And you've got to choose the people to provide a mix. And there's two types of advisory board. One is what we call noses in, fingers in. And the other one is an advisory board, which is noses in, fingers out. Yeah. We operate on the noses in, fingers out premise of that. So the advisory board is three people who will get into a room with you three times a year. And what we have to do is we have to prepare our plan, what we've achieved, what we're working, we hold ourselves to account. We put on Miro, which is an online platform you've heard of, and we share it. And then we get grilled for, used to be a day. I think I'm loving virtual world because we keep it to 3 hours. But normally I have my head on the desk. Yeah. At a certain point, I have headache tablets ready. Because all they're doing is they're stretching, they're stretching our thinking, why we're doing things, how we're doing things, and they're challenging from all different directions to come in. So, but the chemistry of, say, we've got somebody who's an ex-CFO or somebody who's a CFO, we've got somebody who's sales, and we've got somebody who's just Mr. Andrew Webster, who I was talking about before, design thinking. They come from different angles at you. And it's a workout for you. And that's your advisory board workout three times a year. Yeah.
So you're getting a workout as in how wrong you've been all year.
It's that celebration when they go, you did something right. And I'm going, okay, good.
Yeah, you learned something from last time.
Yeah.
We were chatting about this morning, though, John, weren't we, in our session? But I think there's an understated, and it's very understated, value in people asking simple questions, because when you've been working on something for 3 months or a year, you become so baked in your own assumptions about the plan that you're working on that when somebody says, but why is that connected to that? You're like, duh, well, of course it is, because we've done this. And if you were on the project, you'd know. But actually somebody asking that question, it's a very valid question, actually. And if it's not obvious why you've made that leap, perhaps your assumption is wrong or an assumption that needs to be worked on. And I think this is the thing, because it can be very frustrating. I love the fact that you have the headaches at the tablets at the ready. But to put yourself in that level of headache and vulnerability, but being open to the fact that sometimes a really simple question, it does test your assumptions, test where your power structures are, test why you've done things. And I mean, to be able and willing and open to perhaps being wrong at that level with that level of investment, well, that's courageous, right?
And, yeah, and you're paying to receive pain, as we pay our advisors. When you're paying to receive something, it's amazing. We give something for free, you don't really appreciate it a lot of the times. When you're paying for it, as a Scotsman, again, I'm like, I'm paying for this, so I'm gonna get my most out. It's like a personal trainer for you. It's great.
Yeah,
so,
yeah. It's that value in really the feedback. A lot of the time we ask for feedback, and really we don't want feedback. We want confirmation that we're doing it right.
Yeah.
But to step into that space of actually, I want the feedback is awesome. Mm. I did just want to add on about the mentoring, actually, that you said about, because the evidence would show a lot of mentoring, and I think this really relates back to what you said about doing it for others.
Mm.
But often we think about mentoring as something that you should do or it's good to do, but actually the evidence would suggest that physiologically and well-being, the mentor gets more benefit from mentoring than the mentee. So if you are a leader who is struggling with work-life balance or well-being or happiness or positivity, engaging in mentoring will obviously help your employees because you're doing it for somebody else. Yeah. But the benefit that you get as an individual, it's amazing. Like you actually get a lot of benefit from that psychologically and physiologically. So I think that was just a little thing that I wanted to add on. And the power of the reverse mentoring, where you think you know everything and actually been mentored by somebody younger, mentored in TikTok at the minute. It's
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm up to that at the moment. But yeah.
I'm struggling, to be fair. I think I need less social media in my life, not more.
It's
interesting. So yeah, anything else that you would like to share while you've got us?
No, I was going to build on your point, and I'll leave you with this. There's a guy called Jose Luis Guerra, used to work at HSBC, and I was running mentoring programs. And he came across with this absolute passion as a mentor, and he told the stories about the benefit of him being a mentor for others and how he got so much out of it. And I was working in another organization about 4 or 5 years later, and I was telling a story, and I didn't mention the name. I just said the organization. And this person came up to me afterwards, I used to work with at HSBC. Is it Jose Luis Guerra you were talking about there? And so therefore the footprint you're leaving as a leader, as a mentor, where people are talking about you, and I'm still talking about him around the globe for a positive thing, which is about giving back to others, is massive. So you're so right. You mentors get more from the mentees than, how often as leaders do we sit in ivory towers and not get feedback from the people who are at the core of what you're doing as a business? It's a powerful, powerful process. Yeah.
Very powerful. Fabulous. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this conversation and learned a lot, which is always wonderful. If people would like to find out more information about you, where can they find you?
Yeah, bemorewrong.com website. So you'll be able to find more. And then Instagram, bemorewrong. Unless you're not doing social media and you've had enough of social media, just go to the website. But those are the two key places. And Potential Squared is potential and the figure 2.com. And find out more about the business and the VR and other pieces we're doing in that. So yeah, those are the three places. Yeah, and happy to reply to comments or anybody wants to get in contact with me about the 500. I'll send you some details of that. So because that's not officially launched yet, but it's close to being. So I'd love to.
Well, John will drop that in the show notes. But Colin, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope the book flies off the shelves.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Great to meet you, Colin. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.